Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill. With natural foods, they support organic, vegan, paleo, and gluten-free lifestyles. Learn more about their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Hungry Society, the show where we talk about dining, food media, and everything in between. Today's guest is Kwame Williams, chef and co-owner of Vital Dining in Montclair, New Jersey, and Freetown Cafe in Newark, New Jersey. Both serve modern Caribbean food and are a beloved part of their respective communities. He's a graduate of the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City and was a participant in the James Beard Foundation's boot camp, focusing on food system policy and advocacy. Chef, welcome to A Hungry Society.
Hello, hello.
It's so good to have you here. I love your food.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think I've told you like a million times how much I love your take on Caribbean food.
I'm glad.
Yes. So for listeners who haven't been, can you explain a little bit about your restaurants and what they're like?
Well, if we're going to start there, let's start with Freetown. So Freetown, I no longer am running Freetown. I actually sold it back to a friend who originally put us in the space, and he's doing the same concept there. It's a cafe. The energy is still great there. What I fell in love with was the space when we first went in there, and it was amazing. And we'll probably do something similar to that again. To me, I want to have a bunch of Caribbean restaurants, or particularly Jamaican restaurants, that fit different lanes. And that was the cafe, right? That was the place where we were serving Blue Mountain coffee, and we were doing Jamaican pastries and other Caribbean pastries, and we were in that lane. Vital just passed. We just passed our 3-year mark.
Wow! Congratulations.
Thank you. So. 3 years in this summer, and how would I describe Vital? Vital's been evolving, and what it is right now, I guess my sisters describe it as resort. Because it's not a rustic place. It's not high end. It's still very casual, right? It's somewhere where you could go out on a date and you could have on some slacks and a shirt and not feel out of place, but at the same time you could come after you get a gym to get a smoothie and still not feel awkward. So that's the vibe, that's the energy that's there. It's very, very laid back, and it's an elegant, casual place in the sense of the food usually exceeds people's expectations.
So we're gonna get to that, talking about exceeding people's expectations, but let's take it back to the beginning. So when you were growing up, before you knew you wanted to be a chef, or maybe you did know, what was dining like in your home?
Dining in my home, it was I have a lot of food memories, and I don't know if it's just because I'm a chef and have always meant to be a chef, or like to me, everybody has, you know, food memories. I attach experiences with food, and growing up it was a lot of family time. A lot of Sundays were big. Sundays, holidays, everybody wasn't necessarily around the table because there was so much food on the table that you couldn't even eat at the table. It was just everyone would commune, and the family, like, you know, cousins, aunts, and other extended family would all come, and we'd all go to my grandmother's house, and those were essentially my first memories. Those were just just knowing that every Sunday I'm going to see my cousins, where there's going to be a Thanksgiving spread, and you know, we were going to play some type of game, whether it's Blind Man Bluff or some card game afterwards.
So what was on the table? Because it wasn't like, you know, traditional like Thanksgiving turkey, cranberry stuffing.
Oddly enough, right? So in my restaurant, Vital kind of mimics that, right? So my grandparents, my parents, I'm first generation American, right? Mm-hmm. And there were very American staple dishes there. So let's use Thanksgiving as the example, right? There would be turkey there. There would be cornbread. There would be cranberry, right? But then there would also be oxtail. There would be curry goat. There might be roti. So you took everything that you might find at an American Thanksgiving dinner, and then you add all of the staples from the culture, and we kind of just mixed it. And that's what to me my restaurant is now, right? It's a representation of me. It's a representation of the cultural influences are definitely there, but I still am and have grown up in America, right? As many times as I've gone back, as many summers as I've spent, I'm still an American. So then I'm an American with Caribbean roots, and that's what the restaurant represents to me in my eyes.
Nice. So how important is dining in Jamaican culture?
It's huge. It's like, especially like I was making reference to Sunday dinners. It's the same on the island, right? Especially if you have working class parents, at the very least, right? If you get into a space where there's you're eating a lot of leftovers or you're eating out, at the very least, everybody's coming together for to eat on Sunday. Whether that's Sunday morning and you're cooking ackee and saltfish, and everyone is together, or where it's Sunday evening and you're having an early dinner.
Hmm.
So
that's great.
To me, it's definitely rooted in the culture where. You can argue that with any culture, in my opinion, right?
Oh, definitely.
The table is the stable center of people socializing.
Absolutely. It's so important to... All the travels that I've had internationally, I've never been to a place where food is like an afterthought. It's always top of mind for everyone. So growing up, did you go out to eat a lot, or did you go to restaurants, or was it all mostly at home?
It was all mostly at home. Even then, right? So my mother would work night shifts. You know, she would work in the day. She would work night shifts. She would cook before she left. And me just being hungry, how I even found myself in the kitchen was now I was in the cabinet looking for something else, right? My sisters would eat. They would be fine. Mm-hmm. I would still be hungry, scrounging through the cabinets to see what else I can put together. And that's when I started experimenting with flavors. But outside of that, it was mainly home-cooked meals, right? So then even when she wasn't there, she was cooking and leaving it there for us. And I don't even remember, like, restaurants were really just celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have a recollection of the first restaurant I can remember going to.
Do you remember a really good meal that you had that kind of shaped you?
A meal that shaped me. I wouldn't say there's a meal that shaped me. I only say that because as a chef, I'm always looking for something new. So I'm always looking to explore. I'm always looking for a new ingredient. I'm always looking for a new dish. I'm the person, if I've come to your restaurant 10 times, I've eaten 10 different things.
Mm-hmm.
And then that could just be the nature of a chef. A comfort food that I know that I have, it's a sandwich of any form, right? My first food memory was kindergarten, and I don't know how long it lasted, but I know my mother would get me a corner store bodega sandwich for lunch, felt like every day. So then now even going into, like, say I go to a bodega and I smell the vinegar, it brings back that nostalgia. So
what sandwich was it? that she would get you?
I believe it was just a turkey and cheese. And really, it's not even the turkey and cheese as much as it is the smell of the vinegar that gets that. The red wine vinegar just brings back that kindergarten. Like, that was probably the first meal that was satisfying that I could still draw back memories to, just being excited at lunchtime, like, oh, I'm about to get my sandwich. So, and until this day, right, whether it's, you know, because my eating habits have changed, so whether it's a ham sandwich, a turkey sandwich, or even looking for sandwiches outside of the normal realm, something about bread and filler is just super comfort food for me.
That's awesome. That's really great. So let's talk about you then making the decision to go to culinary school and working all over New Jersey. Can you talk a little bit about that progression of, like, all the work that you did to eventually, you know, opening Vital?
Yeah, so I had already been cooking for a while. In high school, I worked at Pizza Hut. Definitely still give that credit because that was my first time using a Hobart. And shortly after high school, I got a job. I did a short stint as an auto mechanic and then found myself back in the kitchen. Worked in different kitchens, Ruby Tuesdays, Fridays, Olive Garden, and...
You worked at Olive Garden?
Yes.
I worked at Olive... That was my first job ever. I was a breadstick girl.
Oh, okay.
See, we have that in common.
I was already so passionate about the business at that point. Well, right, and it goes to the curiosity of wanting more, right? So right. I started at Ruby Tuesdays and kind of hit a ceiling... Went to Fridays, and that was a lot more challenging because the Ruby Tuesdays I was at was relatively slow. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to this super fast pace Fridays, and I'm working the fry station. I'm working the fry station at a point in Fridays where they were still battering everything to order. So,
oh, wow.
Jack Daniel's shrimp and everything.
Do you have the recipe for Jack Daniel's sauce?
The Jack Daniel's sauce at that time was one of the only things coming in prepackaged.
Oh, wow.
All the shrimp and chicken tenders, though, we were battering to order.
Mm-hmm.
And then making my rounds there, right? So incentivized by, you know, getting a raise for every station you learn. And mm-hmm. now I'm working the grill station and you're looking at like 15 Jack Daniel's ribs and 10 steaks and 12 burgers and like wrapping my head around all of that and being able to manage that on a regular basis. Then... It was a manager I actually met at Fridays who was, he was like, you know, you're really passionate about this. And I had a child that was on the way. My son, my oldest son, Zaire, was on the way. And I wanted more. I was like, you know, I wanted more than what I was getting. I basically, within a year and change, learned all the stations and was kind of stuck to just waiting for a yearly review for a raise.
Right.
He suggested I go to culinary school. Ironically enough, I ended up making a lot less money coming out of culinary school than what I was making at Fridays at the time. I think I was, at the time, was probably making $15, $16 an hour to go pay for culinary school. And now, for several years, was working jobs at like $9 and $10 an hour.
Mm.
The food I was doing, obviously, was completely different in the experience and everything else was there, but... When he told me that, I was like, all right. I went, I looked into several different schools, fell in love with ICE. Fell in love with ICE because the flexibility of the schedule and still needing to work. And went to Olive Garden to go do front of house because that, you know, is a lot more flexible. You have 30 servers. You can always get somebody to cover your shift in the last minute if you couldn't get a babysitter or something mm-hmm. like that. So all through culinary school, I served at Olive Garden. After a while, it gave me the respect for the front of the house that I feel every chef should have.
Mm-hmm.
After a while, that, you know, got boring. Then I hosted. Then I bartended. That was a great time. Bartending was great because you were getting paid like you were a cook and you were still getting tipped.
Yeah.
And then I found myself back in the kitchen. And at one point, the running joke was, well, what's Kwame doing today, right? Because I had a host uniform. I had a bartender uniform. I was serving. I was cooking, and did that for the 2 years I was in culinary school. And once I got out, I had my mindset on basically just working at the best places I could possibly work. Did my internship at Rylan Inn. And everywhere from there on, I was like, well, what's the best restaurant in Jersey? That's where I want to work. Mm-hmm. And I would stay there for like a year, move on to another place, stay there for a year, move on to another place. Mm-hmm. And it was a great experience. I got to work under several different chefs who instilled some amazing things in me, right? So, you know, people talk about fine dining dying and the dinosaur that it's become. But the principles that they have towards the food reign supreme, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So whether or not there's enough people with expendable outcome, or not even expendable outcome, just appreciation for the craft and the food itself. Mm-hmm. That's something that, you know, I'm going to carry with me my entire career.
Awesome. So we're going to take a break and we'll be right back with the Hungry Society.
Bob Moore is the founder of Bob's Red Mill, the top quality supplier of grains, flours, and general nutritional goodness from Oregon. He's talking to us about their signature millstones, a very specific way of making whole grain flour. So what's the secret, Bob?
Follow me to the mill room. Well, these are just like the millstones that the Romans used to grind their grains. In fact, these stones came from the same quarry near Paris, France, where the Romans got their stones. The company that makes our millstones pulls their quartz from the same quarry, and they make mills for us that are just wonderful.
Bob explains how the millstones grind much slower and at cooler temperatures than modern steel rollers. The process keeps the grains cool, preserving the flavor and nutrition.
Look at what they produce. I love how they keep things simple and just right. All the nutrition is there, just like nature intended.
After almost 40 years in the milling business, they're serving up over 400 organic, gluten-free, and whole grain foods right here from the mill in Oregon, sending them off to destinations around the world.
We think we can make a difference by sticking to the traditional way of stone milling. And so, that's what we're doing.
To learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their mission to bring good food for all, visit bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, so we're back with Chef Kwame Williams of Vital Dining in Montclair. So let's talk about fine dining and this dinosaur.
The dinosaur that it is.
Why do you say it's a dinosaur?
I don't believe it's a dinosaur, right? Because I obviously have an appreciation for food, quality food, and the overall experience, right? So going out is about the experience, right? So, I call it a dinosaur because the mass market is going in so many other different directions right now. What I do see and I like is the newer places that are popping up all over the place now are still holding that high standard for food. They're just less stuffy. You know, you're not necessarily a place that you have to have a jacket
fine,
on.
The fine casual.
Right. And I love that trend. I love the direction that is going in because the food is still priority. And that's what I love most about fine dining. Mm-hmm. A brief story, I guess I could tell you. One of the defining moments personally in my career, I was working at Bernardsville Inn. And the chef de cuisine at the time, Stern, is what we called him. He was constantly yelling at me. I was never ready. He was always yelling at me about not being ready. And the challenge there, where you're working at maybe like an 8-man line, and I was at Garmager at the time. Garmager is always, they're dealing with the amuse-bouche, they're dealing with the apps, they're dealing with the desserts. And right when some people see a tasting menu and all the line cooks are like, yes, you know, they only have one small dish on there and we have like 6 or 7. The chef pulled me aside after one shift. I had probably been working there maybe like 6 months. And when I was in a groove, just wasn't progressing. And all he saw was my passion for what we were doing didn't align, right? It was like I was more so trying to appease the chef than appease the guest, right? Those were his exact words. He was like, and he told me to come in, right? Because and at the time, I worked at other places that did tasting menus before, and the only thing that it made me curious about, you know, the dishes that we were doing. He made me come in and actually have the meal. And that was, it was a 3.5 hour meal. And I looked at the clock and didn't realize that much time it went by. And just the experience. Now I could fully understand the experience that we were trying to give the guest.
Right.
And it gave me that perspective to be able to be like, all right, you know, I came back to work the next day with that much more passion for how I was going to create the amuse-bouche, or, right, it was less of a job and more of me trying to share the experience with whoever it was that was sitting out at the table.
Right. That's great. So you mentioned this before, but kind of the expectations as far as level of dining. When it comes to Jamaican food or Caribbean food and the food that you cook, can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah, so I meet people all the time in different places. We have great conversation. I tell them I have a restaurant. They go, oh, great. What kind of restaurant is it? And even in the first 2 years, we weren't calling ourselves a Jamaican restaurant. We were just saying Vital, or we were saying it was New Caribbean. Eventually, we put ourselves in that box because our client base was saying, like, you know, I tried to describe it to my friends, and I don't know how to describe it. Sit back looking at the menu, was like, all right, there's definitely a lot of Jamaican influences. This is a Jamaican restaurant. I say that to people, and the first thing they say after they walk in, it was like, oh, my gosh, this place is beautiful. I wasn't, and then it's like, well,
obviously.
What were you expecting?
Yeah.
Like,
of course
they're
it's
like,
beautiful.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, and... And not to say anything against them, right? Because in, let's say, the tri-state area, right? More so, less in New York than in New Jersey. But definitely in New Jersey, all the Jamaican restaurants are takeouts. And then even if there is dining space, it's dining space that people aren't really eating in. It's like, it's almost set up like a Blimpie's. Like, there's chairs there, but there really isn't anybody sitting down.
You're not sitting and like making a full meal of it with drinks and all
right.
That.
So then we come along and try and break that mold, right? So we do live music on some weekends. It's a 40 seat restaurant. So then, but that's usually when I'm taken back, because I'm normally talking to somebody in the industry. If I say yes, it's a dining restaurant, it's fine. If I say it's a 40 seater, I'm expecting you to have some idea of the size. You know, it's not like a grand 250 seat place, but 40 seats is still a decent size. Enough space to create ambiance, but still be quaint. And that's the mold that we're trying to break. That's the expectation that we're trying to beat down. I want to be a voice and an advocate for all Caribbean cuisine. I give people the example when I say what my end goal is you talk to somebody and you told them you were going to a Mexican restaurant 15 years ago, they would ask you, oh, you're going for tacos. You say that to somebody now and they're like, well, what kind of Mexican restaurant? Because it's been expanded to that point. I would love for Caribbean cuisine to get that far, right? When you say I'm going to a Caribbean restaurant, they say, oh, what island? Or, you know, if you're going to a Caribbean restaurant, you know, is it a fast casual? Is it a takeout? Is it a white tablecloth? Because there are many different levels that you can expand on in any culture or cuisine.
Definitely. Definitely. And we've talked about this before, but kind of your vision of where you want to see Caribbean food go, where you want to see Caribbean dining go in America. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's, to me, it's primed to become more mainstream, and obviously I'm an advocate, so where I want to see it go is to the top.
Yeah.
But It has all the elements that I feel like everyone needs right now. So using my restaurant as example, Vital, right? It's casual. We're exceeding the expectations. We are trying to do as much as we can to be conscious of the environment, conscious of health. There are several different ingredients, right? So then even with all the ailments that everybody's having right now and things like that, right? When you think about old, rooted, cultured food, and you figure out, well, why were they so healthy? Why were they living this way, right? And you mm-hmm. think about all the paradoxes that come up. Heavily spiced food usually counters all the negative effects of whatever it is that you may or may not be eating. Right? So in Caribbean culture and Jamaican culture specifically, there is a huge vegan vegetarian population, mm-hmm. right? Whether you're talking about Rastafarians or people who are just influenced by Rastafarians to now go vegetarian or vegan. It might look like we're chasing a wave when we're only just being true to the culture, and the culture, the mass culture, is now catching up to what has been happening all this time already.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. I've seen a bunch of articles. Well, veganism is one of something that's become kind of, you know, very trendy, but also you see things like, you know, Aki, you know, mm-hmm. articles like, what is this fruit? And it's like, people have been eating this for a very, 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 very long time. So with your peers, you do a lot of events, you work with a lot of different chefs. What do you think of today's dining culture?
Today's dining culture.
How would you like describe it?
I would describe it like, I would make the comparison to music. One could look at it and say everything is just washed and watered down, but because so many people are allowed to do things independently now and do things on their own, it's never been as diverse. And as long as you're looking in the right places, you can find some really high quality stuff that nobody knows about. Right. And the goal is to get other people to know about it and, you know, and fill the place up. But yes, I would make the comparison to how I feel about music right now. And the mainstream is the mainstream. But then within there, there's several different pockets and several different types of places that are thriving. And just like I said before, are putting food at the forefront. Mm-hmm. Right. The where you have a lot of chefs who are passionate about the food, and yes, it's a business, but they pride themselves at doing quality, good food rather than I'm in the business to make a dollar and whatever people want to buy, I'll sell it to them.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any favorite restaurant experiences that you've had lately?
Recently? There's nothing that jumps out to me recent.
Do you not like a lot of places that you go out? Is it?
I do. I love a lot of places, and I understand. So then critical and not critical at the same time.
Right.
So like, let's say I go out with a bunch of friends and we go to some place and they're tearing the place apart and like ripping them left and right about, oh, is this or was that? I sympathize, mm-hmm. right? Because so then I'm thinking what might be going on. Like, yeah, it was a party of 10 that just came in on this 20-seat restaurant. Like, yeah, we might have made a reservation, but how equipped are they really to handle us? In the same breath, I'm hard to impress, mm-hmm. right? So then I'll get a great meal. And in that meal, what I'm thinking about is, if I was to do this, what would I do mm-hmm. to make it better? Mm-hmm. Right? Where did this meal fall short? So, I mean, you could give me an amazing experience, an amazing meal, and I'm still nitpicking. I'm still, right? I might probably verbalize it. I'm not going to go on Yelp and tell you a new one.
I'm thinking, any chefs use Yelp.
I'm thinking for my own personal use. Yes, Yelp is like, It's great, and it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, I would love to know if any chefs have ever used Yelp. That would be very interesting.
I use it to find places.
Okay, yeah.
I'll find a place, and I can read through the negative comments to see, like, all right, this person just had a bad experience, mm-hmm. and that's not, one bad experience isn't indicative of the restaurant, but I can read between the lines. Like, there's several ones from my own restaurant where I'd read it and it was like, all right, so the server may have said or did something to aggravate you, and now you write 10 paragraphs ripping us, but then ended, well, the food was still good, though.
Yep.
And it's like, but you just gave us a 2-star, complained about something, right? And not to neglect service, because service is very important. And at the end of the day, you probably just weren't having a good day. And if you have a passionate server, they'll notice that and treat every person differently and try and, you know, be that light in your day. But at the same time, that's not their responsibility either. And then,
right.
But you give the people that opportunity to just say what they want to say. And their voices are valid. I'm not discrediting anybody, because if that is the truth and that's what they experienced when they were there, then that's what it is. I'm looking at a review and saying, well, I could look at your menu, see what I might want, look at your reviews and get an expectation of what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it's going to be indicative of my experience. Even if I'm coming in and you have 5 stars and everybody's raving.
Right.
That just gives me a barometer of what to expect. And is that in line with what I'm looking for right now?
Right. So if you had to have a last meal at a restaurant, where would it be and who's invited?
A last meal at a restaurant. Where would it be and who's invited? Oh, man, I'm so conflicted with this with this question, right? Because so then first, as soon as I hear last meal, I start thinking about people who I may want to meet and sit down and have conversations with. And we're just like, all right, it'd be great to be in the room with them and we have good food in front of us. And then I start thinking, well, last meal, do I really want to spend my last meal with a stranger?
Right.
am I just going to go with the family thing? But then now if I'm going with the family and I go, all right, well, I've been talking about eating at 11 Madison Park forever and have still just never made a reservation. Are my family members going to appreciate that experience?
So that's true. Like, I mean, it is your last meal, though. So maybe they'll put up with 11 Madison Park for one evening.
Both
answers. You can give both instead of one.
So, right. No. So let's say I'm going out with some chef friends, right? Well, if we're going to break it up, we'll go with 3 last meals, right?
Okay.
If I'm going to go with some chef friends,
you've
right?
You've got some notice. You have 3 days notice.
Yes.
And I'm
going to go out on a big hurrah. The first day I'm going to like get a bunch of chef friends and we're going to go to somewhere like Madison Park, in my opinion, right? Not necessarily them, but somewhere where I know that I can sit down, we're going to just sit for hours and forget that we're there and the food is just going to keep coming out. And we're going to talk about the food. We're going to talk about experiences that we had and just have a great time. The other thing, put me in a room with a bunch of strangers who I think are amazing personalities, whether they're athletes, musicians, politicians, right? And I would probably cook that meal, right? And I cook that meal, put my heart into it, put the food on the table, and you kind of use that as the talking point. After Hours or After Dark. It was a show. It was basically similar to that, right? Right when his restaurant closed, he would have people come over, and that experience is something that I was like, oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then finish it off. Similar to the holidays, right? Where I might, if I think about it, on the holidays, I really don't cook anything, right?
Really?
All my
you
family
take it
members
off?
Is like, oh, you cook all the time, let us cook. And just really spend that last day with my family, my children, you know, and my close friends, and we just eat and laugh, and that's how it would end it out on my 3-day experience.
And so it would be in that order.
Yes.
Chefs.
Definitely have to end it with the family.
Personalities and then family.
Yes.
I think that's a pretty good lineup. Mm-hmm. So my last question for you, Vital Dining. I've been there. I love it. I think everyone should go. Can you talk a little bit about the future and what you see for the future of Vital?
What I see for the future of Vital. It's so strange because every time you hit a new level, there's a new wall to climb over.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're in the third year. Right. First year, I was just super excited to have my own restaurant, call myself an executive chef of somewhere, be cooking the food that I want to cook. Now, as I'm growing as a business owner, even now in year three, right? Because in year two, it was about just filling up the seats, and I started doing more television and did some stuff with Food Network and so on and so forth, and just trying to get exposure. We're going, you know, year three, and it's like we're looking, mm-hmm. right? We're looking at, well, all right, lease is going to be up in 2 years. Do we move? Mm-hmm. Do we consider moving? Do we stay? You know, well, rent's going up, but what we're making is the same. And
mm-hmm.
For me, in the future of Vital, well, one is to keep Vital alive and keep it going, right? The premise was to build something for my children to now benefit from.
Mm-hmm.
Where that's going to be, right, whether we stay in the same space and we continue to grow right where we're at and just continue to invest in that property, or we move. What I was thinking, and in the ideal world, right, probably what's going to end up happening is we stay right where we are and we just keep cultivating that that clientele, that area, in that base. And we just venture out, similar to the cafe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the cafe was in year two. That was my first time venturing out. That was my first time experiencing running two properties at once. Now, with all of that behind me and now looking at leases ending and how that plays a dynamic in your end goal, our next property that we're looking at would be like, all right, let's build up enough capital or enough investors or something that we're getting somewhere where we're buying the space. And that, to me, is the next step to get out of the leasing, right? Because now as a worker, it was like, oh, I want to get to a chef. And now as a chef, it's like, oh, I want to get to my own restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Now as a restaurant owner, it's like, oh, I want to own my own space and property.
Right.
So
always another wall to climb over.
It definitely is. And so that's to me, that's the new goal. That's the next obstacle.
Well, that's exciting to hear, and I wish you and your sisters all the best.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on A Hungry Society.
I'm happy to be here.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Great energy, and I'm willing to come back as another guest any other time. You have somebody else in here, you want like a co-host. And
yeah. We have to bring ackee and saltfish.
Yes.
That's
I can do that for you.
Okay. It's a deal then.
I'm actually going to be at Star Chef's Congress this year. The theme is Cook Your Culture.
Oh, perfect.
And I'm going to be doing ackee and saltfish there. So.
Excellent.
Look out for me, people.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for coming, Chef. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Always.
All right. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.